This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2019, held on March 22 and 23, 2019, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
Good afternoon. As Courtney was standing there introducing me, my mind went back to many years ago when I was school teacher at United Christian School, the Christian school in Napanee there, and one of my students was Courtney's dad, and so that just makes you feel old. It was not the First Nations people in Canada; it was the Sioux Indians in Cherry Creek, South Dakota. Just to make that, we didn't have to call them First Nations. In fact, they made Indian tacos. And we loved Indian tacos. They taught us how to make those, so we could still use that word back in Cherry Creek. At IGO, I taught a missiology class. And in preparation for that class, missiology is a huge subject. And how do you teach that in 3 weeks? And so what I'm sharing today is really part of, born out of my studies in that class. And I share it because I personally found it very interesting to learn what we're going to share today. And by looking at history, we can see God's hand actually moving in missions. And we can see, by seeing that, we can actually get some direction for our day. And so that's kind of what we're going to cover. The title page right there, the work of art that is on there. How many of you are familiar with the Moravian mission movement? They actually got on board with missions before the general Protestant churches did. And Count Zinzendorf was a man born to rich family and went to college, and his parents had plans for him. He had some leanings towards Christianity, more deeper than some of his friends. And when he was on a tour, and I forget what town, I think some maybe in France, and they were touring an art place, an art museum. And he came upon this picture. And the title of this picture, the artist entitled it, "Behold the Man." And Zinzendorf, he stopped and he looked at that picture, and they had this inscription with that picture. "I have done this for you. What have you done for me?" And Zinzendorf's testimony is that his eyes were glued to the picture and to the thought, to the question. And it changed his life. It changed that work of art, changed the course of his life. And through his influence, the Moravian missionaries began their work. That was the beginning of missions after the Reformation. I want to just give you some dates. This is a very risky workshop to have at this time in the afternoon. I thought about it as I was in the workshop next door this past hour, a very good workshop on battle. And I felt my eyes getting heavy, and I thought, oh no, what am I going to do? And then I had a former IO student come up and just say, "Keep me awake." And so my goal is to do that. And so we just might have to stand up about halfway through and do calisthenics. My IGO students would let you know that I actually have them do calisthenics in the classroom at 7 in the morning. Anyway, I want to give you some dates that we could look at here. And the Reformation, could you tell me, make some wild guesses. I understand. I mean, you'll knock me over if you get the date right. But what date did Martin Luther nail that thesis on the doors of Wittenberg? What year?
1517.
Boy, you guys are good. You guys are impressive. All right. What the next step? When is the date given, the year given, that those first two Moravian missionaries set out in missions. Does anyone know that date?
It was the early 1700s.
Very good. 1732. My math is correct. That's over 200 years after the Reformation. The Christians. And mind you, the Catholic Church was already busy for centuries. And that's why you can go to these countries in Haiti and other places, and there's all kinds of mixed religions because of the Catholic missionaries that have gone for years. But the Protestants didn't get on board till over 200 years. The Moravian missionaries are somewhat set apart from what we would know as the modern Protestant movement. William Carey is known as the father of modern missions. He's the one who started the Baptist Mission Society. Does anyone have any idea what year William Carey began that movement? It was yet 60 years even after the Moravians. It's kind of interesting. It's not that long ago. We're talking about 1800 that Protestants got a hold of this thing called missions. It's really kind of baffling, because it's, to me anyway, and I think to most of us here, because we're here because we're excited about missions, it's kind of baffling that it took the Protestants after the Reformation so long to get a clue. In fact, when William Carey, so we're gonna look at what we call, I'm just gonna tell you, give you a little what we're gonna look at. We're gonna look at three eras, what missiologists have called three eras, E-R-A-S, you'll see it on the board, of mission movements. And some would say that third era is the last. I say no. I think there's one more to go, at least. And that's what we're gonna wrap up with. So William Carey, about 30 years of age. He started getting a burden that somehow we should be reaching the lost people in other countries. And he went to a group of ministers. He was a young minister. He went to a group of older ministers. And he proposed the idea of missions. And there he is. The first era, if you want to get the date, is about 1800 to 1910 is when coastline missions began, reaching the coasts of other countries. William Carey was the motivator of this. He took his idea to that group of ministers, and this was their answer. When God chooses to win the heathen, he will do it without your help or arms. That was what he was faced with. The idea was so radical. It's amazing. Carey didn't give up so easily. His response to that was he wrote a booklet. It's called An Inquiry into the Obligations of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathens, in which, and so on down. It's a long title. It's just probably did not hit the bestseller list, but I'm sure it was interesting, and he was cutting edge in writing that idea of using our means to reach the heathen. And he wrote that booklet. In 1792, Carey authored the small booklet that inspired the first stage of Protestant mission efforts. As a result, his own organization, the Baptist Missionary Society, was formed. Within 25 years, 12 more mission societies were formed. So Carey was just the father, what we call the father of the modern mission movement. This era, in the first 60 years of this stage, very few missionaries that went to Africa survived the first 2 years. And I just have to think, you go into missions today, you can Facebook back home anytime you want. You can Skype call, you can WhatsApp, you can do whatever you want. We hardly know what it is to leave home and do missions. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but could you imagine the kind of interest that we see today here in this facility, 2,000 people, can you imagine? Would there be that kind of interest if we knew the brother so-and-so died we wouldn't get the news for months. But he died on the field, and sister so-and-so, and the young married couple that we sent died on the field, and these guys died on the field, these guys. And if you knew that you're going to go and you're going to die within 2 years, would we have this kind of interest? It'd be amazing if we would, wouldn't it? But missions, it doesn't even cost us today like it cost them. And it's still so hard to get people to go. We heard about that this morning in Rick's message. Just a very, very, very good message for us. Coastline missions, that's just what it was going to cost. This first era focused on primarily on the coastlines of Asia, Africa, Hawaii. It was commonly believed that when the missionary worked himself out of a job, he should return home. Once you've got these churches established, and I almost put it on a slide, but I knew that my time is going to be short. How much history can you cover? I thought, okay, I'll just verbally say it. And that is, in this first era of missions, they came up with a plan, a structure, a framework of how to do missions. And that was, they used P's to do it, so it's easy to remember. The first stage of missions, and it's still true today, the first stage of missions is the pioneer. When you go and you start, it's, whether it's inner city or whether it's halfway around the world, you are a pioneer. And the pioneer stage, you're going to have to do just about everything yourself. You know, we're doing an inner city church, and we restricted it to about 5 families until we start getting some community people coming. And guess what? Everybody, it's all hands on deck. Everybody has to help out. And that's the pioneer stage. The next stage is the parent stage, where you get some converts, and basically you have to parent them. You teach them like a parent would a child, because they do not know. And the next stage is the partner stage. And that's where you start partnering with a leader, a future leader, and you train them to lead. And then the last stage is participant, where you step back and the work goes on and you participate as you're invited. That structure actually came into being in this first stage of missions from 1800 to 1910. The second era, from 1865, and I want you to notice the overlap, okay? I'm going to back up here. That one, they say, basically ended in 1910. But the second stage began starting in 1865. And it went to 1980, not that long ago. This stage was called inland missions. That first stage hit the coast. Missionaries, they went to the coasts. They didn't go any further. When those churches got established, they came home. Hudson Taylor was a very name familiar to all of us. He was the one who started thinking about taking the gospel deeper in. And he was thinking of China. And in 1865, Hudson, now I want you to notice too, Carey was about 30 years old. Hudson Taylor was about 33 years old. We're not talking about old, we see the pictures of them, all gray-haired, but when they had their vision, they were young men. They were young men. Nothing wrong with that. Hudson Taylor was about 33 years old when he became burdened for missions beyond the coastline. And he especially was burdened for the people of China, going into China. And he shared his vision with others, just like Carey did. And believe it or not, he met with much the same reaction. You dare not go in beyond the coast. It's dangerous there. It's not safe. And if you send young people into those places, their blood will be on your hands. That's what Hudson Taylor was told by his leaders. And that shocked him. I mean, it set him back. He didn't want the blood of young people on his shoulders. You know, God is faithful. And God said this to Hudson Taylor. God said, "You are not sending young people into the interior of China. I am." And when Hudson heard that clearly, he moved forward. And his work began many interior missions, the Sudan interior missions. His was called the China Inland Missions, the Sudan Interior Mission, African Inland Missions, Heart of Africa Mission, Unevangelized Regions Beyond. That's a name we're familiar with today. Many interior missions began because of Hudson Taylor's work. It didn't happen overnight. It took 20 years for Hudson Taylor for other Protestant mission groups to catch that vision. Another thing Hudson did was we picture him, at least I always used to, pictured him spending all of his life in China, but he didn't. He would come back to Europe and mobilize people. He spent as much time on the road mobilizing people for missions as what he spent in China. So he would travel back and forth. J. Hudson Taylor was not just interested in China, he was interested in the church getting a burden for missions. In this era, in the second era of missions, they saw what would likely be the largest movement, mission movement in history. Colleges got involved, American colleges got involved, European colleges. And these college students, when they went to the, I'm going to finish reading it before I make my comments, through the zealous era of youth, the four stages of the missionary role, what I just had told you, pioneer, parent, partner, and participant. Those four stages were challenged. That's not the best way to do missions. And what they did, and I'm going to finish reading it before, and proven again to be the most effective way to plant churches, those involved in the era became highly successful in their missionary pursuits. What they did is they got to the coastlines. They were going to go into the interior. They got to the coastlines, and they saw these churches with the native leaders, and it didn't match up to what their culture thought a Christian church should look like. Are you with me? And we talked about this in my workshop earlier today about ethnocentrism. My way is the best way. And so they saw where these native pastors were just lacking. And so they basically got sidetracked. And they pushed the native pastors. They didn't go into the interior. They pushed the native pastors aside, and they're going to do church the right way. Pretty soon, boom, 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 people started leaving the church. And so it was a zealous error, and they actually proved, you know what? Let's let the Holy Spirit build his church. We can kind of get in the way if we think we got a better way and we think it has to be done our way. We need to allow the Holy Spirit. That was a lesson learned in this second era of missions. Once they got into the interior, once they got past that, once they relearned their lesson, they did become highly successful. By 1940, mission societies began assuming that indigenous churches could complete the outreach into the interior. They began to pull their missionaries back home. And one thing that really added to that was the Second World War, with the American troops being all over Europe and trying to stabilize Europe, actually after the end of the war, 1945. And so the phrase, "Yankee, go home," became a common phrase. They were tired of the American occupation, and countries were feeling like, we can handle this ourselves. And that even bled into the churches and into missions. And so there was just kind of a movement for, even from them, it's time for the Yankees to get out of here and go home and let us live our own lives. And so as that era came to an end, a new era came to birth and started actually in 1934. And UPGs, Unreached People Groups, began in 1934 as you've got the missionaries reaching the coastlines, now you've got them going into the interiors, but what about there's still pockets, there's still groups of people. And there's two key motivators that are given credit for bringing to our attention the Unreached People Groups. And William Cameron Townsend is one of them. You don't recognize his name, but you will recognize his work. Townsend was 27 years old when he went to Guatemala as a second-year missionary. He was going to go into the interior of Guatemala. And he had Spanish Bibles with him. He was working among the Kachiquel Indians. The Kachiquel Indians did not speak Spanish. They spoke Kachiquel. He was trying to sell Spanish Bibles. Guess what? Sales were down. They did not know Spanish Bibles. And one Indian came to him, and again, it's interesting how, like, these moments in time, right, that God uses to just move us. And so I think, let's take a lesson from that. I think one thing that God has impressed me with in the last 10 years is my sheep know my voice. And I'm thinking, do we know his voice? I mean, young people struggle to know God's will. I just want to know God's will for my life. How can I know God's will? How can I do this? How can I know? They struggle and they fret. And Jesus said, my sheep know my voice. Stranger's voice they don't know. And they go, well, what's wrong with us? Do we know his voice? And I think we need to be more sensitive to his voice, to those impressions. When you're at a McDonald's and there's somebody at a table and you hear that inspiration, you should go and talk to them. They look troubled. And you, they're immediately you say, oh, what are they going to think? And we start backing off and all of that. No. You know what? We need to learn the voice of God. And that's what happened with William Carey. That's what happened with James Hudson Taylor. William Cameron Townsend, an Indian came to him, a Kachiquel Indian came to him, and he said, if your God's so smart, why doesn't he speak our language? Yeah. You know what Townsend did? Townsend began to live among the Kachiquel Indians, learned their language, analyzed the grammar, created an alphabet, translated the New Testament in the Kachiquel language in the span of 10 years. He came back to Arkansas and began in 1934 what was given the name Camp Wycliffe. This camp was designed to train young people in basic linguistics and translation methods. 2 students enrolled. Wycliffe Bible Translators. Such small beginnings. All because a Kachiquel Indian said, if your God's so smart, why didn't he speak our language? From that work, many ministries have grown. We even have our Anabaptist Bible Translators now, which is very exciting. But SIL, JARS, Jungle Aviation Radio Service, many of these committed to reaching the unreached people groups with the Bible in their own language. That's William Cameron Townsend, the beginner of Wycliffe Bible Translators. The next man that is given credit for this era is Donald McGavran. He's given the title of the father of church planting. He wrote a couple books. One is called The Bridges of God by Donald McGavran, the father of the church growth movement and understanding church growth. McGavran was born to second era missionary parents in India. They sent him to the States to get educated. He returned to India. He was very successful in missions, second era missions. In 1932, he became the head of the mission organization in India. He had 80 missionaries under him. He had the care of 5 hospitals. He had numerous schools. He had a home for lepers. And he had 20 to 30 small church plants. Some were slow growing, and others were much quicker. Some would grow about 1% a year, while a couple grew at rates of 50 to 100% a year. And he decided to find out, what's the difference? Why are some church plants just growing and other church plants aren't? And he set out to find that difference. And so he dropped all of being in charge of all of those things. And he spent the next 18 years as a pioneer church planter himself. And he tried to learn the methods. And he planted 15, in that 18 years, he planted 15 churches with over 1,000 converts in that day. If you want to learn what he learned, you can still find his book, The Bridges of God, available. During this era, this third era of missions, attention was drawn to all the unreached people groups within what is now called the 1040 window. I'm sure we're all familiar with that. That's a term that came into being during this era of missions. And a second focus is that of the church planting, church growth. This era is seeing third world countries. We're seeing China get involved. We're seeing South Korea getting involved. This era, third world countries are becoming involved in these movements also. With that in mind, with that as a backdrop, and that's a quick look at history, I want to look at this diagram just to show you the waves. They're called waves of history. This diagram's not original with me, but I did one wrong click, and that's what happens when you do one wrong click. Okay. This is the button I wanted. 1792, William Carey, the Haystack Youth Movement, they're the missions that start going to coastlines. And we come across here, and it comes to an end, but already the second era is starting with Hudson Taylor. And there's about 46 years of overlap here. And that's going. And the second era of inland missions, it lasted 115 years, coming across here. And this overlap, again, was about 45 years. We begin the one that we're in today, 1934 to today. Third, something, final era. It's going to bypass the hidden people, the unreached people groups. I'm going to show you a map. It's very interesting if we consider missions of the world. When the Apostle Paul, on his first missionary journey, we know that it started here in Israel. And you've seen the maps. The first, the second, the third missionary journey through here, just up into these areas, all around here. Didn't go eastward. It went this direction. A couple of interesting facts about that is, if I can remember, these are not in my notes, but 500 years, approximately 500 years before Christ, when the children of Israel were prisoners in Babylon, and King Nebuchadnezzar gave that proclamation, we heard about it this morning, that every nation is to worship the God of Daniel and his three friends. King Darius made the same proclamation about 70 years later. Every place underneath my rule should worship the God of Daniel. 500 years before Christ, when Neb made that proclamation in Babylon, right over here in India, Siddhartha Gautama, 500-ish B.C., started what we know today as Buddhism. If you think of the spiritual battles that go on, as the gospel is being proclaimed pre-Christ by Daniel down here in Babylon, over here, Even when every nation shall worship the God of Daniel over here, the devil's busy getting Buddhism started. The same thing happened as the gospel began spreading in the early church, 200, 300, 400. 500 AD is when, again, over in India, in this area, the Muslim movement began. So whenever God's kingdom moves forward, the devil's busy too. Anyway, for our intents today, Paul made these journeys here, the gospel spread up here in the 1200s, up into the Slavic nations. And then we have Christopher Columbus and the pilgrims going across here, and the gospel being brought here, freedom of religion. We want to worship Christianity. We want to worship the Lord Christ. And the gospel continued to spread from this coast on across this country here. And then we had the Reformation happening in Europe, and it took a long time for missions, Christians, to get missional again, but they did. And they started to move to the coast of Africa and India. They just kind of missed these coasts here, these countries here. Africa, India, and then they did the interior missions, and they went in. They also hit Hawaii, which isn't on either side of this map. I'm glad nobody's here from Hawaii. They could be offended. But today, this map here is actually a map of the religions of the world. Christianity is purple. Green is Islam. And we have some mixtures here. Okay. Hinduism is the orange. Buddhism is the yellow. And on down, Judaism is the blue. And on down, Chinese, Korean, Shinto folk, no religion at all. But the gospel has moved, for some reason, westward. And then to Hawaii. And it wasn't until the third era that we found this term called the 1040 window. And Christians, especially in America, became more, my batteries must be getting a little low, became more concerned about the 1040 window. And we started sending people to the 1040 window. And we've had missionaries. We have missionaries in Asia. We have missionaries in Southeast Asia, in China. We've done well at that. And we've done well at Papua New Guinea, all of those areas. Northern Africa even. But there's an area in this era that is untouched, basically. And just now, we are becoming more aware of it. And that area is the Muslim countries. Christians in China, again, like what I said earlier, the third world churches are becoming more involved. They are becoming concerned about missions. The Christians in China, I'm sure most of you have heard about their movement called Back to Jerusalem. And I think it has some credibility as I've studied and as we can see on the map how the gospel has moved to the west and back over here to these coasts in Asia through Hawaii and through Australia, New Guinea, and those islands down there. And we've moved through China. We moved through Southeast Asia. But the Muslim countries. And it's a very interesting thing. As I studied missions, the God has four ways. That's a very poor word to choose what I want to say. But God has four processes of making missions happen. Because this is God's plan. God wants every tribe, every people, every ethnic group to know him. The first method, that's what I'm looking for. The first method of missions is that the Christian goes to them. We go. Voluntarily. Sometimes Christians go involuntarily. Prisoner of war, captivity, like the children of Israel, the gospel, not the gospel of Jesus Christ, but the religion of God, the knowledge of one true creator God, went to Babylon. It went to Egypt as they were taken captive, made slaves in Egypt. God wants people to go. He wants his people to go. And that will happen either them going voluntarily or them going involuntarily. Two other methods that God uses, and we're seeing this today, folks. Two other methods that God uses is if his people won't go, he'll bring the people to the Christians. And that can happen voluntarily, and that can happen involuntarily. And it's amazing to me, as I watch the hand of God moving. First of all, it's amazing to me when I watch the hand of God moving with the voluntary going of many, many Latin American people into the United States. And brothers and sisters, I have heard Mennonites complain about the Mexicans in our communities. I have heard Mennonites complain about the Spanish language signs that we see different places. And I have heard Mennonites say, if they want to be Americans, then let them learn our language. I am thankful the 3 years that we lived in Chiang Mai, Thailand, for every English sign I found in Thailand. If you've ever been in another country, you know what I'm talking about. Did you ever think that God might bring these people because we haven't gone to Mexico and to Latin America as we should have? Oh, we got a mission here, we got a mission here, and we got a mission here. But we haven't gone like we should. So God, third method, is he brings them voluntarily to us. So let that be a wake-up call rather than something to complain about that I've got this Mexican living in my neighborhood. God have mercy. Who are we? The fourth method is people coming to the Christians involuntarily. And we see that with the refugee crisis. They don't want to leave their homes. If Lancaster County got bombed and there'd be fighting in the streets and bombs going off all over, something tells me you wouldn't hang around. You would involuntarily leave looking for some refuge, a safe place to live, a safe place to take your children, your babies, your grandchildren. And that could happen. We've never had it happen here. But that is happening for real in many, many, many cities with violent Islam. And we have this influx of refugees. What are we doing about it? And I really believe, and they're mostly Muslim. And I really believe, brothers and sisters, that the gospel needs to go through those countries yet. And whether that's by God bringing them here for you and me, or for us going, whether it's safe or not. You see, it's a little bit easier taking the gospel to Southeast Asia. I mean, that's not easy. But it is a little bit easier taking the gospel to Southeast Asia than it is to take it into the Muslim countries. And you can't even get into Saudi Arabia. I would love, on my bucket list, and it's never going to happen. Maybe I serve an amazing God. Maybe it will. I get to go to some amazing places. God's opened some doors for me. But I would love to go into Saudi Arabia sometime. I would love to go there and take the gospel, but you can't hardly get into Saudi. Even Americans can't hardly get in there. But you know what? I like to tell my students, there is absolutely no country close to the gospel. You could take the gospel to North Korea. You may not get out alive, but you can get in. You can sneak in. There's no closed country. Whoa, that's out of the box for us safe Mennonites, isn't it? That's kind of out of the box, but there is no closed country. Oh, I'd love to go to Saudi Arabia sometime. Maybe you'll hear the Collier diet in Saudi Arabia. You'll know that it was on his bucket list. I would love to. You can't even get close to it. But I would love to look at the Kaaba is all I can think of. But it's the whole city. Help me out, Mecca. Have you ever? I challenge you. Go online. Go look at a picture of Mecca. It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. It looks like a fairy tale thing. I would love to go and get in view of Mecca and just pray God's gospel to sweep that whole city. I'd love to be able to be there and pray. Shoot me after I've got that prayer done. I'm okay. Just, I'd love to be able to pray over Mecca. The gospel needs to go there, folks.
Yes.
The gospel needs to reach the Islamic nations. They are not our enemy. We do not have enemies as Christians. The gospel needs to go through those countries. We can learn that. I think every wave, everything of history points to, as the gospel has swept from here, through here, across the oceans, into the coastlines, and through China and through Southeast Asia. Boom! Where are we? Right here. That's the fourth wave, maybe the final wave of missions. I challenge you, young or old, if you're young enough to go, go. If you're older, don't be like the old men of William Carey's time or the old men of Hudson Taylor's time. And say, oh, don't go. It's not safe. You dare not go there. Send them. It's time we take the gospel back to Jerusalem. I really believe that. My questions, are we in the last era? I don't think we are now. I think there's a new era that's beginning. I think there's an overlap. Typically, the overlap's about 45 years. I believe we're overlapping. I believe there's a new movement starting. God's starting it. He's bringing the people to us involuntarily because we aren't willing to go. Oh, there are a few pockets. Praise the Lord. Let's multiply those. Will we get the job done? I like to tell young people, you're on stage now. This is your time. The gray-haired people, we're passing off. We're moving off the stage. If young people... If this generation doesn't reach this generation of Muslim people, who's going to do it? It's your job. Will you personally be the vessel God needs you to be to accomplish what He wants to accomplish through you? Any questions? How many minutes we got? I didn't see your last few cards. Any questions? Comments?
Four methods again. That
God uses?
Yes.
Voluntarily go. The Christian voluntarily goes. The Christian involuntarily goes. It doesn't happen much. Through captivity, through maybe we'll end up going with bombs in our cities. Who knows? They come to us voluntarily, or they come to us involuntarily.
What was going on in the Eastern Church during the first two, during the third phase? You mentioned that was kind of when the Eastern Church started to get involved. What was going on in the Eastern Church during these first two phases where we mostly talk about what was going on in the Western Church as far as attending?
In the Eastern Church? When you say the Eastern Church, you're talking about the churches in Europe?
No, I'm talking about like Korean, Chinese, all of like the Eastern Church.
In the first and second eras?
Yes.
Absolutely nothing. They were very much involved with animism. Animism is the basic religion of any nation. Hinduism is actually the oldest religion, other than the religion of Creator God, which is us. But Hinduism is actually the oldest religion, and that actually had its start in the Indus River of India. But that's strictly nothing but animism and spiritism. And that's what the Chinese, the Asian countries. That's where they were. And then Buddhism, two kinds of Buddhism. And the one is very evangelistic, and that's the one that spread eastward into towards those countries from India. But that would have been about 500 B.C. So Buddhism making its move. Yeah, those were the religions. Every man served his own god. The Hindus have over 330 million gods.
You mentioned a number of individuals who were the founders of these movements, the way it started, the way. Were there also church groups that were instrumental? Or was the church actually kind of inactive?
In those first two eras, the church, it's sad to say, and we're very church-oriented, okay? This is Protestant missions movement. We're very church-oriented that we would not maybe recommend someone going out on their own. Let's have the church's blessing. But actually, William Carey and Hudson Taylor did move forward without the blessing of those over. I got 0 minutes. I'll turn it over to Courtney. For those of you that don't know, he's back there holding up cards. It's his job. He gets paid to do it.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.